The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Welcome to a Wednesday, and what an exciting Wednesday it is. Oh, my goodness. Where to begin? I guess we start with Paul Ryan retiring. Paul Ryan, you know, if you're a regular listener to this show and you hear Howie Klein, who's with us on Thursdays, he'll be back tomorrow. He's been telling us for a couple of months now that this was going to happen, that Paul Ryan would not run for re-election. And sure enough, that is the news. As of today, Paul Ryan using the want to spend more time with the family. You know, the kids are growing up. I'm a weekend dad. We'll hear his statement when we get to what's news in just a few minutes. But big news out of Wisconsin and more good news for the Democrats. Then there's Donald Trump. Who makes news every day, but he started the day. Let me see if I can't bring up this, his tweet storm here. Actually, I've got this in what's news as well. You know what? We should just do it. We should just get into what's news because I've got a live extended version of it for you today. I'll tell you what's going on today. David Dayen will be here. It's been a while since David Dayen's been on the show. And to be honest with you, the only reason it's been so long is because he is so prolific. The guy is, I don't know how he keeps everything straight in his brain. He must have an enormous brain. You can tell him I said that. But for the last couple of days, he's been watching the Facebook hearing. So we'll talk about what's going on Capitol Hill with Mark Zuckerberg. We'll also find out why his Twitter handle now is, instead of his name, it says ban targeted ads. So we'll find out about all that when David Dayen joins us at the bottom of the hour. But I'll tell you what, because it is such a busy news day. Let's get right on with the news, shall we? Let's start here.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, as I said before, the day began with the news that Paul Ryan would not seek re-election in November. He made it official during his usual Wednesday morning press conference.
You realize something when you take this job. It's a big job with a lot riding on you, and you feel it. But you also know that this is a job that does not last forever. You realize that you hold the office for just a small part of our history, so you better make the most of it. It's fleeting. And that inspires you to do big things. And on that score, I think we have achieved a heck of a lot.
Heck of a lot.
You all know that I did not seek this job. I took it reluctantly. But I have given this job everything that I have, and I have no regrets whatsoever for having accepted this responsibility. This has been one of the two greatest honors of my life. The job provides incredible opportunities, but the truth is, it's easy for it to take over everything in your life, and you can't just let that happen, because there are other things in life that can be fleeting as well. Namely, your time as a husband and a dad, which is the other great honor of my life. That's why today I am announcing that this year will be my last one as a member of the House. To be clear, I am not resigning. I intend to full my served term as I was elected to
My served term.
But I will be retiring in January leaving this majority in good hands with what I believe is a very bright future.
Sure you do.
It's almost hard to believe, but I have been a member of Congress for almost two decades. This is my 20th year in Congress. My kids weren't even born when I was first elected. Our oldest was 13 years old when I became Speaker. Now all three of our kids are teenagers. And one thing I've learned about teenagers is their idea of an ideal weekend is not necessarily to spend all of their time with their parents. What I realize is if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen. So I will be setting new priorities in my life. But I will also be leaving incredibly proud of what we have accomplished. Some of you know my story. My dad died when I was 16, the age my daughter is. And I just don't want to be one of those people looking back at my life thinking I spent more time with my kids when I know if I spend another term, they will only know me as a weekend father. So I'm really proud of what we've been able to do. When I took this job, one of my conditions was that we aim high, that we do big things, that we fashion an agenda, that we run on that agenda, that we win an election, and then we execute that agenda. I am so proud that that is exactly what we have done and what we are doing right now. We've accomplished so much since then. Probably the two biggest achievements for me are first, the major reform of our tax code for the first time in 36 years.
Yep.
Which has already been a huge success for this country, and that's something I've been working on in my entire adult life. Second, something I got much, much more invested on since becoming Speaker is to rebuild our nation's military. And after tax reform addressing our military readiness crisis, that was a top priority that we got done last month as well. These I see as lasting victories that will make this country more prosperous and more secure for decades to come. There are so many other things that we have gotten done. And of course, I'm going to look back proudly on my days at the Budget Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. But I don't want to be too sentimental here. I want to be clear. I'm not done yet. I intend to run through the tape to finish the year. Some of you wonder why I can't just do the normal politician thing, and which is to run and then retire after the election. That is what
because
I'm told is the politically
shrewd
thing to do. I considered that. But just as my conscience is what got me to take this job in the first place, my conscience could not handle going out that way. I pledged to serve the people of Wisconsin, the first district, honorably. And in order to serve the people in my district honorably, I have to serve them honestly.
Right.
And for me to ask them to vote to reelect me, knowing that I wasn't going to stay, is not being honest. So I simply cannot do that. So that's why I'm announcing this today. Again, I am proud of what this conference has achieved, and I believe its future is bright. The economy is strong.
Sure you do.
We've given Americans greater confidence in their lives. And I have every confidence that I'll be handing this gavel on to the next Republican Speaker of the House next year. So just to close, I said earlier that I didn't want this job at first. And you, most of you know this. I really actually didn't. But I have to thank my colleagues for giving me this opportunity and this honor. I am really grateful for it. I also want to thank the people of Southern Wisconsin for placing their trust in me as their representative for the past 20 years. I've tried to bring as much Wisconsin to Washington as I can in that time. It's been a wild ride, but it's been a journey well worth taking to be able to do my part to strengthen the American idea. That pursuit is never ending. Much work remains, but I like to think I have done my part, my little part in history, to set us on a better course. Thank you.
By the way, Jonathan Cohn just tweeted out, Paul Ryan didn't privatize Medicare, repeal Obamacare, or decimate food stamps. It wasn't for lack of trying. And Richard R.J. Eskow tweeted, Paul Ryan was always a phony who pretended to be a wonk. He was a master of the Potemkin PowerPoint presentation. By the way, this resignation of Paul Ryan's, I guess not retirement, I guess is more the accurate term, makes it that much easier for Randy Bryce to win the election for Congress from Wisconsin's first congressional district come November. So good for him. By the way, if you're wondering what the last Speaker of the House is doing, John Boehner tweeted this out this morning, and I kid you not, John Boehner who likes his wine, likes his cigarettes, I guess also likes the ganja, because he tweeted out, I'm joining the board of Acreage Holdings because my thinking on cannabis has evolved. I'm convinced descheduling the drug is needed so we can do research, help our veterans, and reverse the opioid epidemic ravaging our communities. That's what John Boehner is doing now. He's going to be lobbying for a marijuana company. My, how quickly they change when they leave Congress. And Paul Ryan, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Donald Trump started his Wednesday with a series of tweets aimed at Russia and Syria. He tweeted this. Let me see if I can do it. Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they'll be coming. Nice and new and, in quotation, smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it. He soon followed that with another one. Our relationship with Russia is worse now than it has been, than it has ever been, and that includes the Cold War. There is no reason for this. Russia needs us to help with their economy, something that would be very easy to do, and we need all nations to work together. Stop the arms race, question mark? Okay. By the way, Trump, where did I put it? Back in August of 2013, you know, when Barack Obama was considering bombing Syria after a suspected sarin gas attack, Trump tweeted out, "The president must get congressional approval before attacking Syria. Big mistake if he does not." There's a tweet for everything, you know. Trump canceled his planned trip to this coming Friday to Peru for the Summit of the Americas, according to Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, to oversee the American response to Syria and monitor developments around the world. So now we're waiting to see what Trump is going to do when it comes to Syria. There's a, Ed Markey, Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, is saying Trump does not have the authority to launch missiles at Syria. It's got to go through Congress first. So this is setting up to be a big fight, regardless of what happens. But he's got his generals assembled. Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before a joint Senate Commerce and Judiciary Committee panel on Tuesday, answering questions from 42 senators, during which time he repeatedly apologized and promised privacy reforms. Today, he is at the House, testifying before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Yesterday, while answering questions from Dianne Feinstein, as I get my questions together here, he addressed Russians meddling in the elections.
One of my greatest regrets in running the company is that we were slow in identifying the Russian information operations in 2016. We expected them to do a number of more traditional cyber attacks, which we did identify and notify the campaigns that they were trying to hack into them, but we were slow at identifying the type of new information operations.
When did you identify new operations?
It was right around the time of the 2016 election itself. So since then, 2018 is an incredibly important year for elections, not just with the U.S. midterms, but around the world. There are important elections in India, in Brazil, in Mexico, in Pakistan, and in Hungary that we want to make sure that we do everything we can to protect the integrity of those elections. Now, I have more confidence that we're going to get this right because since the 2016 election, there have been several important elections around the world where we've had a better record. There's the French presidential election. There's the German election. There was the U.S. Senate Alabama special election last year.
Explain what is better about the record.
So we've deployed new AI tools that do a better job of identifying fake accounts that may be trying to interfere in elections or spread misinformation. And between those three elections, we were able to proactively remove tens of thousands of accounts that before they could contribute significant harm. And the nature of these attacks, though, is that, you know, there are people in Russia whose job it is to try to exploit our systems and other internet systems and other systems as well. So this is an arms race. Right? I mean, they're going to keep on getting better at this, and we need to invest in keeping on getting better at this, too, which is why one of the things I mentioned before is we're going to have More than 20,000 people by the end of this year working on security and content review across the company.
Where was all this a couple of years ago is my question. Meanwhile, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois pointed out that the problem with pointed out the problems with Facebook's intrusions into our privacy.
Would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you've messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that may be what this is all about. Your right to privacy, the limits of your right to privacy, and how much you give away in modern America in the name of, quote, connecting people around the world. A question basically of what information Facebook's collecting, who they're sending it to, and whether they were asked in advance my permission to do that. Is that a fair thing for a user of Facebook to expect?
Yes, Senator. I think everyone should have control over how their information is used. And as we've talked about in some of the other questions, I think that that is laid out in some of the documents. But more importantly, you want to give people control in the product itself. So the most important way that this happens across our services is that every day people come to our services to choose to share photos or send messages, and every single time they choose to share something, they have a control right there about who they want to share it with. But that level of control is extremely important.
It's a lot more nuanced than that. One of the big issues is the fact that Facebook is a monopoly, a point that Lindsey Graham was unsuccessful in getting Mark Zuckerberg to admit.
Wait, if I buy a Ford and it doesn't work well and I don't like it, I can buy a Chevy. If I'm upset with Facebook, what's the equivalent product that I can go sign up for?
Well, there's the second category that I was going to talk about.
I'm not talking about categories. I'm talking about is there real competition you face? Because car companies face a lot of competition. If they make a defective car, it gets out in the world. People stop buying that car. They buy another one. Is it an alternative to Facebook in the private sector?
Yes, Senator. The average American uses 8 different apps to communicate
all
with their friends
Facebook.
And stay in touch with people, ranging from texting apps to email.
Which is the same service you provide?
Well, we provide a number of different services.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
Okay. So it doesn't. So Instagram, you bought Instagram. Why did you buy Instagram?
Because they were very talented app developers who were making good use of our platform and understood our values.
It was a good business decision. My point is that one way to regulate a company is through competition, through government regulation. Here's the question that all of us got to answer. What do we tell our constituents, given what's happened here, why we should let you self-regulate? What would you tell people in South Carolina that, given all the things we've just discovered here, it's a good idea for us to rely upon you to regulate your own business practices?
Well, Senator, my position is not that there should be no regulation.
Okay.
I think the Internet is increasingly
important.
Do you embrace
regulation?
I think the real question, as the Internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should be or not.
But you as a company welcome regulation?
I think if it's the right regulation, then yes.
You think the Europeans have it right?
I think that they get things right.
Have you ever submitted? That's true. So would you work with us in terms of what regulations you think are necessary in your industry?
Absolutely.
Okay. Would you submit to us some proposed regulations?
Yes, and I'll have my team follow up with you so that way we can have this discussion across the different categories where I think that this discussion needs to happen.
And therein lies one of the big problems. They're asking him to self-regulate. Will you supply us some of the regulations you think should be, lorded over your business? Yeah, I'd like to regulate my own business. Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, not my favorite senator, but occasionally he gets off a good line or two. He had a few pointed remarks in addition to his questions.
I don't want to vote to have to regulate Facebook.
Of course you don't.
My God, I will. That a lot of that depends on you. I'm a little disappointed in this hearing today. I just don't feel like that we're connecting. So let me try to lay it out for you from my point of view. I think you're a really smart guy. And I think you have built an extraordinary American company. And you've done a lot of good. Some of the things that you've been able to do are magical. But our promised digital utopia, we have discovered, has minefields. There's some impurities in the Facebook punch bowl. And they got to be fixed. And I think you can fix them. Now, here's what's going to happen. There are going to be a whole bunch of bills introduced to regulate Facebook. It's up to you whether they pass or not. You can go back home, spend $10 million on lobbyists and fight us, or you can go back home and help us solve this problem. And there are two. One's a privacy problem. The other one is what I call a propaganda problem. Let's start with the privacy problem first. Let's start with the user agreement. Here's what everybody's been trying to tell you today, and I say this gently. Your user agreement sucks.
You get the idea. Actually, so one of them printed out the user agreement, and it was a stack, you know, yay high of pages that I would go out on a limb and guarantee not one person who has ever clicked agree has ever read the entire thing. The only person who's read it are the lawyers who drafted it. There are problems with Facebook. I'm still on Facebook. I don't use it that often. Actually, what I use Facebook for is basically when I use Twitter, my tweets go onto Facebook, and occasionally I'll go on Facebook and converse with people. I know our pal Gotta Laugh is getting off of Facebook. She's deleting Facebook, as are a lot of other people. Maybe that's a topic one day we will talk about. And David Dayan has been watching these hearings. He'll be joining us in about 10 minutes or so to talk about more than just the sound clips we've been hearing here. Again, today, Zuckerberg is back in the hot seat before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. I'm not sure how much longer they'll be going, but hopefully they end soon because we've got David Dayan coming up in a little while. Meanwhile, the president is still reportedly seething over the FBI's raid of his attorney Michael Cohen's office, home, and hotel room, with speculation running rampant that he's considering firing Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. This from CNN.
Our team has learned that the president's consideration of firing Rod Rosenstein has gained urgency following the raid of the office of the president's personal lawyer. Sources familiar with this matter say this is one of several options on the table right now, including going so far as to fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions as well. This is what the president is weighing. Now, officials say if Trump acts, Rosenstein is his most likely target because installing a new deputy attorney general could provide the check on Mueller that Trump is seeking. Now, we should note, Aaron, that not all of Trump's legal advisors are on board with this, but others are telling him that they now have a stronger case against Rosenstein. They believe he has crossed the line in what he can and cannot pursue, and they consider him conflicted since he is a potential witness in the special counsel's investigation because he wrote the memo that justified the firing of former FBI Director James Comey. So even though Trump has considered firing him in the past, the possibility has taken on a more serious tone in recent days, according to sources we've spoken with.
So there's that. Now, the question is, does the president have the right to fire Robert Mueller? He does have the right to fire Rod Rosenstein. There are those who assert that only Rosenstein can fire Mueller. Anyway, at the White House press briefing yesterday, Sarah Sanders was asked about Trump's assertion that the raid was an attack on our country and whether Trump had the authority to fire Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller.
Sarah, talking about the raid on Michael Cohen's office, the president said it's an attack on our country. It's an attack on what we all stand for. In what way is an FBI raid on Michael Cohen's office an attack on our country?
I think that the president has been clear that he thinks that this has gone too far. And beyond that, I don't have anything to add, but I'd refer you back to the president's comments.
Would that accounts to an attack on our country?
Again, I think the president has been clear what his position is. I don't have anything else to add
at
this
point. Does the president believe he has the power to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller? Does he believe that's within his power?
Certainly believes he has the power to do so.
Right here in the front. Said earlier, you said the president believes he has the power to fire Robert Mueller because usually most legal experts believe that he would have to order Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to fire Mueller, and Rosenstein could, of course, refuse.
I know a number of individuals in the legal community and including at the Department of Justice said he has the power to do so, but I don't have any further announcements on.
They've told me, I've asked, they've said that it's Rod Rosenstein oversees special counsel and only he has the power to fire the special counsel.
Again, we've been advised that the president certainly has the power to make that decision. I can't go anything beyond that.
You know, we keep hearing there'll be a constitutional crisis if the president were to fire Mueller. What that would look like, though, is your guess is as good as mine. Meanwhile, here's some breaking news. This just hitting shortly before airtime. The Senate Judiciary Committee is moving forward with legislation to limit Trump's ability to fire Mueller. Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, a Republican, wants to add the bill to the panel's business meeting agenda scheduled for tomorrow. Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor yesterday said this.
By his own words, it's clear the president may be considering firing the special counsel. This Congress must respond forcefully and on a bipartisan basis by reaffirming our belief that the president cannot fire special counsel without cause, and by passing legislation to ensure that any attempts to remove Robert Mueller will be unsuccessful. We should not abide the president's attempted assault on the rule of law in America. The eyes of history are upon us.
It's scary times. The legislation is bipartisan from Senators Christopher Coons and Cory Booker, two Democrats, and Tom Tillis and Lindsey Graham, two Republicans. It would let Mueller or any other special counsel receive an expedited judicial review within 10 days of being fired to determine if it was for a, quote, good cause. If it wasn't, the special counsel would be reinstated. The measure would also codify existing regulations that only a senior Justice Department official can fire a special counsel and that they must provide the reason in writing. Tillis told The Hill that he wasn't certain the bill would be able to get a vote on Thursday, but said it would certainly happen here in the next week. So that's a big change. The committee action would come after two previous special counsel bills languished for months without a vote. If the bill passes out of committee, it would also put pressure on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to let it come up for a floor vote. McConnell on Tuesday said he saw no need for a vote on legislation protecting Mueller because he doesn't believe Trump will fire him. And that's been the problem all along, is the Republicans are protecting Trump instead of protecting Mueller, saying they don't believe he would do it, trying to sort of, I don't know, send him signals, I guess, through the ether saying, don't do it, don't do it. And there was one question in yesterday's White House press briefing that I thought was the question of the day, and it came from April Ryan.
Sarah, two questions. The president said yesterday he was compliant. They turned over a million documents. If he was compliant with these investigations, why was there a search warrant needed?
This doesn't have anything to do with the president, and I would refer you to Michael Cohen and his attorney. When it comes to matters of the special counsel and dealings with the president, we've been fully cooperative.
Okay, next question. With all of this turmoil, particularly this last week, has the president at any time thought about stepping down before or now?
No, and I think that's an absolutely ridiculous question. I gave you two questions, April. We're moving on. Jordan, go ahead.
It's not ridiculous.
It's not ridiculous. It's not ridiculous. And actually, that's probably an answer that Sarah Sanders has no clue. Has the president ever considered stepping down? His ego probably wouldn't allow him to, but boy, what a good thought. Anyway, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side with David Dayen, who's been glued to his TV watching the Mark Zuckerberg hearings. We'll check in with him next. It's Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com. and the Progressive Voices Network.
What do you get when you combine ignorance, imperiousness, and incompetence? I'll not only tell you what you get, but who. Today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. Question: what do you get when you combine ignorance, imperiousness, and incompetence? Answer: Betsy DeVos. She's Donald Trump's multi-billionaire education secretary who hates public education and loves the plutocratic idea of corporate rule over democracy. DeVos is so bad that she's winning the contest for worst member of Donald Trump's cabinet, a little like winning the title of ugliest toad in the swamp. She's been a shameless shill for one of the ugliest parts of the financial services industry, the Wall Street-backed network of for-profit colleges, rip-off lenders, and ruthless collection agencies. Some 5 million students, largely single moms, veterans, and other low-income people, have been forced to default on their student loan debt and have had their credit ratings and job improvement prospects destroyed by this profiteering private education system that DeVos carelessly promotes. Her latest favor for the industry was to assert unilaterally that her agency can preempt any state laws designed to stop the blatant lies and abuses of this predatory network of corporate education. Her bureaucratic claim is that state efforts to protect student borrowers undermines, quote, uniform administration of student loans. In her shriveled world of laissez-faire-land values, you see, the uniform gouging of students trumps such basic human values as economic fairness and social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, heavens to Betsy, what's wrong with this lady? Our nation's student loan debt has ballooned to $1.4 trillion, threatening to blow another big hole in our economy. Yet she's stupidly conspiring in her department's back rooms with Wall Street's fast-buck educational exploiters to enrich them at the expense of students, taxpayers, and the public interest. DeVos is the one who needs an education, both in economics and ethics.
If you'd like more of Jim Hightower's real populism, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter gives you the real lowdown on which corporations, by name, are doing what to the middle class, our environment, and our democracy. Each month, the Hightower Lowdown brings you facts you didn't know, along with actions you can take to fight back. It also comes with a sense of humor. Hightower believes we can fight the gods and still have fun. Plus, get this, it's cheap. Only $15 brings you 12 issues a year. For real populism, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back, and I'm excited to talk with our next guest because it's been a while since he's been on. David Dayan is a contributor to The Intercept, also writes for The Nation, The New Republic, and lots more. He's one of the most prolific journalists out there today. He's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, now out in paperback. And I believe he's been glued to the TV for the last couple of days watching the Mark Zuckerberg hearings in the Senate yesterday and the House today. Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. And you?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. I think I mistook this to be taking place 3 hours ago.
Oh, no.
Because I'm on the West Coast, but that's okay.
Okay.
It's not a problem.
Okay, good. Oh, sorry about that.
I always have to figure out, well, do they mean East Coast or
yeah,
West Coast?
And I always try to remember to write Eastern and Pacific, and if I screwed up, I truly apologize for that.
Not a problem. Happy to be here. Happy to talk to you.
So how's old Mark Zuckerberg holding up today?
Well, not as well as he did yesterday. I think that yesterday I wrote a story for The Intercept about those hearings and how the Senate seemed very content to sort of let Zuckerberg handle whatever problems they perceived at Facebook with respect to the data harvesting by Cambridge Analytica and other various problems with data collection and ad targeting. The House wasn't really as generous in terms of sort of, you know, allowing self-regulation to take hold and just saying, hey, you take care of that, Mr. Zuckerberg, and we'll get back to you. I think it might be the fact that, you know, if you are in a congressional district, you don't have the same pressures in terms of having to raise money for statewide office. And you can be a little more aggressive in these particular situations. And they certainly were. I mean, and on both sides of the aisle, by the way, we saw members really drilling down and grilling Zuckerberg about anything from the fact that there are sales of prescription opioids on Facebook that is completely illegal. The fact that users of Facebook are tracked even when they're not on the site. The fact that non-users are tracked through Facebook tools on any of hundreds or thousands of sites across the internet. And, you know, I think one of the more important bits of questioning today came from Anna Eshoo, and this is pretty important because she represents Silicon Valley in Congress, and she just sort of gave the threshold question to Zuckerberg: are you willing to change your business model in the interest of protecting individual privacy? She got the point that the business model is surveillance. That this is the point of Facebook. They want to get your data and as much as possible wherever you are on the internet in order to exploit that data for the benefit of targeted advertising. I mean, that is the model. And Zuckerberg tried to pretend that he didn't know what she meant by business model. The guy's a CEO. He's run a company for 14 years. He knows what a business model is. He knows that this is the key question. He wouldn't answer it. And so I think you're seeing some real aggression and understanding that Congress, through its abdication of responsibility over the last 40 years, has let this internet economy get completely out of control, and that real you know, it's a real scrambling that needs to be done to return to a state where power is not concentrated in the hands of so few people.
Does he admit that there's a problem with the harvesting of user data, or is that something that he's pushing back on?
I mean, what I feel Zuckerberg has been doing in throughout the course of these hearings has been engaging in a practice of very, very well rehearsed lies and half truths. He claims that, for example, there are ways to make your data portable from the site when it doesn't give you all the data. You're not able to go to another social media site and you know, put up a post and have it read by all of your friends that were on Facebook. That is the point of interoperability. There is no interoperability with Facebook, and yet he's claiming that they comply. He alternately says that the U.S. should follow, U.S. users should get the same kind of protections that are about to go into play in Europe, which would require affirmative consent for any kind of data collection on Facebook. But at the same time, he says that the Americans have, quote, different sensibilities when it comes to privacy. So he is skirting the issue. He is making sure he doesn't commit to absolutely anything. And in many cases, he's just flat out lying about what it is Facebook does. And when he doesn't know the answer to something, he says, well, we're investigating that and we'll get back to you. When it's really government that has the role of investigating when there are violations or potential violations of law. And so that's sort of my feeling on it.
Did he explain how Facebook uses its data with regards to advertisers? You note in the piece you were talking about up at The Intercept, the Senate is afraid to govern. That's great news for Facebook is the name of it. I'll link to it in today's blog post along with the podcast. You noted that he was, quote, super proud of stating that Facebook doesn't sell its data to third parties. So if they don't do that, then how do third parties ostensibly get it?
Right. Well, the way it works, and this is where I think that Zuckerberg was making a distinction without a difference, Facebook does not sell the data so that third parties and advertisers can use it, to their own devices. What he does is he has a staff of advertising professionals who say, if you want an audience of any kind, someone who likes music, someone who is between the ages of 18 and 24 and, has a taste for a certain kind of food, or someone who we've read in their messages likes a certain kind of book, we can target your ad to that individual directly and anywhere they go along the internet. And do they sell the data? Are they renting the data?
Right.
Is the data in the cloud? Who cares? I mean, it's still the fact that advertisers get this hyper-targeted ability to find individuals that might be interested in their products. And what we see is that kind of hyper-targeting can inevitably lead to abuse, whether it's, it's a targeted ad when someone who is selling prescription opioids is going after a segment of the population that they think might buy it. I mean, that's Facebook being a pusher. That's a targeted ad. That's compelling content for those individuals, right? That's something compelling to their interests and relevant. Advertisers who are advertising housing or employment opportunities say, we don't want African Americans to be part of those, to be able to see those ads. That's available on Facebook, and ProPublica has written about this continuously. Facebook promised to take that down a year ago and still hasn't, and there's a major lawsuit by civil rights groups saying that you continue to allow this feature to advertisers. So the whole idea that just because Facebook isn't selling its data, although, of course, it let third-party developers, in the case of Cambridge Analytica, get the data, and use it in what way they saw fit. The fact that they're not selling it is immaterial to the dangers of centralizing, collecting as much data as possible and allowing advertisers to use that surveillance for their own needs.
Right. And that is their business model. So when you
indeed.
Right. And so, in essence, was he basically saying maybe Facebook is too big to fail? I mean, this is what they do.
Well, that was an interesting, there was a very interesting moment with respect to, this situation with opioids with, Congressman McKinley of West Virginia. And he said, we've told you about these sales of oxycodone and OxyContin on Facebook, and you don't take them down. And Zuckerberg said two things. Number one, he said, we're working on rolling out sophisticated, quote unquote, AI tools, artificial intelligence tools, to make sure these things get stopped. But the other thing he said was very interesting. He said that, well, basically, there are millions of posts all every day on Facebook, and no matter how many people we hire, we can't possibly get to them all. And what that is an admission of just what you said, that it's too big to manage, that complying with the law is impossible when it comes to Facebook. And that is complying with the law, because it is illegal to advertise illegal substances over the internet. So he was basically saying that we're going to refuse to follow the law because it's not cost effective for us to hire enough people to do it, and anyway, we're too big to get it done as a practical matter, and we're going to wait until there's technology that enables us to do the job without costing us our record swollen profits. So that got to the real heart of this whole thing, is that, Facebook doesn't want to hire humans to do these jobs to comply with the law. They would rather put it out to a robot.
Wow. We're speaking with David Dayan, who has a great piece up about yesterday's hearing in the Senate up at The Intercept. I'm guessing you'll be writing about what happened today in the House as well.
I am.
Also,
I'm also writing about what was interesting is that there was a separate hearing today in the Senate Commerce Committee, which was one of the committees that talked to Zuckerberg yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And this hearing was for a nominee to the Federal Trade Commission, which is the federal agency that has jurisdiction over the tech industry, over consumer protection, over data privacy, and also over mergers and acquisitions and anti-competitive behavior. So this is an agency that would be overseeing Facebook. And these senators who talked to Zuckerberg yesterday expressed, several of them, Democrats and Republicans, frustration over Zuckerberg's answers, saying that that Facebook clearly violated the law in 2011 when they made a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission over data privacy. They clearly violated that consent decree. Two different senators said that. Roy Blunt, who is nobody's populist, said, you know, that these look like monopolies. Facebook and Amazon, he mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and that we have to do a better job of scrutinizing these companies. So not only the fact that the House has been much more aggressive than the Senate, but the fact that the Senate almost displayed buyer's remorse today in saying that talking to the FTC and making the FTC nominees aware that they're expecting the FTC to do its job and really take a look at Facebook's business model and their market power and make sure that they are complying with all applicable laws. That was really important today, and it's turned me around on this a little bit and thinking that we're sort of at the very beginning of this, not the end. That if Zuckerberg thinks that he's gone through 2 days of hearings and he's going to walk away, that's not how this is going to go.
So if there is regulation, hopefully coming down the pike, I heard one of the senators, I'm drawing a blank now as to which one it was. I'm thinking it might have been actually Lindsey Graham, was saying, would you write some regulations and submit them to us? I mean, did I hear that correctly?
That was Orrin Hatch.
Oh, that was Orrin Hatch.
Oh, my God. I mean, the Senate hearing was ridiculous on that front. The entire framing of the hearing, this idea that it's up to Zuckerberg to regulate, self-regulate, essentially, Facebook, and not up to members of Congress, that was the entire sort of overarching framing of the hearing. Bill Nelson, your senator down in Florida, said something like, if you and these social media companies don't get your act in order, none of us are going to have privacy anymore. Which that's a ridiculous statement to make. It's up to the government to govern privacy, not a social media company. There seemed to be this sort of unwillingness to govern. And really, the senator's comments to the FTC nominee really kind of reflect that. Like, this is your job, not our job. They're kind of putting off the inevitable. But I saw more and more. And Lindsey Graham was one of the few that didn't do that. And he out and out said, Facebook's not going to be able to lead here, that we're going to have to take the lead because a big company like this is not going to regulate themselves. I mean, didn't we figure that out after the financial crisis?
You would think so. But now they're trying to undo everything that was done to protect us after the financial crisis, too. So they seem to learn their lessons. We talked a bit about advertising, the creepy nature of you search for something online and then you get these ads, whether on Facebook or on Google or wherever you go online for the things that you search for. Again, that's their business model. What about the propagation of hate speech and so-called fake news? And did he address that too and how that spreads through Facebook?
That certainly played into this. And it's another example of the sort of downsides of all of this mass data collection and surveillance. I mean, what we know about the meddling in the elections is that it was extremely targeted. These groups that wanted to push a message to individuals who they thought they could sway against voting for Democrats and voting for Donald Trump. It was a very particular audience. We know that Facebook collects like 29,000 different data points on its users, and they can target very granularly who might be susceptible to a certain message. Wow. And we know that not only did through the Russians, but also through Donald Trump's own Facebook targeting campaign, which used millions and millions of ads, they could really pinpoint who they needed to go after. And some would say maybe, well, that's just good political maneuvering. But it's also the fact that this was unregulated largely. You didn't know where these were coming from. You didn't know if these were credible sources or not. There was no Federal Election Commission involvement. And you essentially had a private government run by a boy king trying to figure out how to handle this very consequential question that went to the heart of who got elected president of the United States. So it's impossible to deny that. And Zuckerberg, you know, that's one of the things that they've really come out on and said, we're going to do a better job on this. And we have, you know, these new standards in place where if you want to put an ad on Facebook, a political ad, you have to be in the United States, and we're going to mail you a code. And so you're going to have to be at that address that you say is in the U.S. And, you know, that's all fine and good, but it's also not his job. It's the job of the government to make sure that elections are protected to the extent possible. And so we cannot avoid having the government get involved.
Is the government capable? It seems that it's so far behind the wheel, you know, that's the wrong expression, off the ball, just that it doesn't have its shit together when it comes to anything having to do with the cyber world. We seem to be so far behind, the Russians, for example.
Right. Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, a lot of people were sort of mocking the Senate on Twitter yesterday, saying they don't even know how to use their own phone. How are they going to, you know, regulate the internet?
Right.
But it's interesting. I mean, Lindsey Graham is probably the least tech literate member of Congress. He might be. Until very recently, he used a flip phone.
That's right.
And didn't use email. And yet he gave the most piercing questions there were yesterday, because he recognized the core danger of Facebook, which is that it's too big and too powerful. So I don't know if you have to know everything there is to know about the internet to have that perspective. I mean, members of Congress didn't know everything there was to know about healthcare, and they managed to create Medicare.
True.
Members of Congress didn't know everything there was to know about the banking industry, and they created Glass-Steagall and the Banking Act of 1935 and the Securities Exchange Act. You do not need like this comprehensive understanding of all world knowledge to know that a company that has between them and Google 99% of all new advertising spending is a duopoly. There are two companies that essentially control the digital advertising market,
mm-hmm.
and that's a problem. And you can see the negative consequences of that. So I'm not unbelievably hopeful, because we are still talking about Congress right here, right? But at the same time, you know, we're going to have a new Congress come next year, and people are more interested in these issues. And the House, and certainly the House, and to a lesser extent the Senate, are showing an awareness of what we've sort of let get out of control here. And I think you're going to see a sustained campaign of over many years. I mean, obviously, Facebook has a ton of power to block any of this, but you're going to see a sustained campaign to try to do something about this.
Good. Well, I hope so. You have also have a piece up at the New Republic called ban targeted advertising. In fact, I'm guessing you feel so strongly about it, you changed your Twitter handle to ban targeted ads instead of your name, instead of David Day, and it says ban targeted ads.
That was mostly for this week, just for this rollout. But I'm 45, and for the first 35 to 40 years of my life, I managed to get around without being tracked everywhere I went on the internet or anywhere else. And I managed to figure out what was out there in the world that was available to buy in terms of goods and services. And, companies survived and other companies didn't. And I got what I needed and everything was fine. The idea that there's this great utility in being surveilled and then given these ads that are based on that surveillance, I don't think it's good for the for me as an individual. I don't think it's necessarily, it's certainly not good for publishers who lose sort of their brand value. If you can be tracked all across the web, advertisers don't have to go to the Wall Street Journal to find you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not good for them. And it's questionable whether it's even good for advertisers. I mean, we've all had this experience where we buy something online and then for the next 2 weeks we get these targeted ads for that same product as if we need two or three or four or five of them.
Right.
I think the idea that these targeted ads are positive for advertisers is actually a bunch of hype. And some companies are starting to figure that out. Procter & Gamble, the biggest advertiser in the world, just significantly reduced their digital ad spending because they thought it was a waste of money.
Hmm.
So if you put all that together, that the value is questionable and the negative consequences are great, and we're seeing more and more and more of them. And it's problematic for privacy. It's problematic for our democracy. It's problematic for discrimination. And you put all that together, and it's hard to come up with a compelling reason why we still need this regime. All it seems to do is make a bunch of people in Silicon Valley obscenely rich. And the rest of it is really an open question. And there are such negative consequences to it. So I really strongly believe that we don't need this regime, that we can roll back to the time of 2008 and advertisers will be fine, companies will be fine, and individuals will be fine. They'll get along without getting an ad for light bulbs because they said to somebody in an email that they need to pick up light bulbs.
Right. But it is those targeted ads that Trump's, what's his name, Brad Parscale, credits for winning the election for him, that they're able to target down to the individual person, the precise ad to show that person. That gets into really creepy territory.
Absolutely. And there are certainly, what I'm not saying is that you can't provide sort of market research to tell people, well, the New York Times has an audience that we think, they make $100,000 a year and they're very literate and educated and, they'd be a good fit for your product. Yeah, that's normal stuff that we've seen in advertising since time immemorial.
But that's like mass targeting. That's not individually targeting.
Exactly. Individual targeting is what I'm after. And, it means that political campaigns can still go door to door and they can still, find their voters and engage in phone banking and run ads, certainly. But it's when you get to this individual level, the costs just seem to outweigh the benefits.
It is this brave new world that we've entered, and it's kind of scary. David Day, and the piece on yesterday's hearing is up at The Intercept. The Senate is afraid to govern. That's great news for Facebook. It actually is. Facebook did well on Wall Street yesterday, huh?
Yeah, but we'll. I wonder what's happening right now. Let's find out about Facebook stock, because I really thought Zuckerberg took a drubbing today. Looks like it's about even today.
Huh. I don't understand the stock market. Anyway, will your piece up about today be up at The Intercept as well?
Yes, it will.
Okay. I will look for that and link to that as well. David Dayan, it's great to talk with you. I'm sorry it's been so long. I always appreciate your time and your insight. I'm a big fan of yours.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye. David Dayan, again, his book, Chain of Title, is a must-read. If you're interested at all in the mortgage, the foreclosure crisis, you got to read it. It should be a movie. With that, we're done for the day. Don't forget, tomorrow, Howie Klein is back. He'll have a lot to say about Paul Ryan, I'm sure.